ready to rock and roll.
We are ready to rock and roll. Okay, my microphone was broken, so I want to make sure it's picking me up. So it's picking me up fine. Can you
touch mine?
Should I touch it?
Yep, you're doing fine.
Okay.
All right, so today is June 24th, 2010. Uh-oh. This is our fourth and final interview with Jim Stakely. We're here at Steenbach Memorial Library. And I know there's some things, Jim, you want to conclude with, but there's also some things you want to go back and clarify, I guess, starting with the your comments from a previous interview about the TAA strike. So
right.
If we want to start there.
Thank you.
And go from there.
Okay, fine. Well, last time I said, you know, that the strike was, I don't know, I named some year, and I said maybe I was involved in two strikes. But in fact, the strike in question that I was so heavily involved with took place in March and April of 1980, a 5-week strike. And the TAs went back to work. They gave up. And looking at my own vita, I see that what happened is, you know, when I was hired here, the first 2 years I was here as a lecturer, I wasn't yet on a tenure track appointment. And the part of the deal was the German department chair, Walter Snollendorf, had this vision, I think a very good one, of wanting to create a special new area of focus within the German department, especially in terms of undergraduate students on German culture, which would be different from, distinct from German literature, and that was the standard major, and also the kind of available courses in German linguistics. And so this third area was to be promoted, and the notion was he wanted to get the dean behind this. And when I was hired, it was just a kind of a 1-year contract, and then that was renewed for yet another year. And then he came to me and said, ah, success, the dean, that was Dean Cronin at that time, who was actually kind of pro-German, pro-German department, pro-German studies, as a person with a background in history. I think his own, if I understand it correctly, his son had studied in the Freiburg Year Abroad program through the German department. And Dean Cronin was a big opera goer and liked German as well as Italian opera. So he was kind of pro-German. So Walter Snollendorf, the chair, came to me and said, ah, Dean Cronin has approved that that there can be a slot that can be a tenure track position. And I believe that, you know, probably what we had to do at that point was once again do a kind of a national search. I can't remember. I may have been just changed in rank from lecturer to assistant professor on a tenure track. But I'm not entirely certain there. It may be that, like, you know, we were required to do some kind of a national search at that time. But I had the inside track, and I did get the job. So actually, this TAA strike, taking place as it did in the spring of 1980, March and April, that was my first year as an assistant professor on tenure track here at the UW-Madison. And that's also partly why my senior colleagues, the lefties that I mentioned earlier, Klaus Berghahn and David Bathrick, were saying, oh, you don't have to, you know, you don't worry. Go ahead and cross the picket line. That's okay, you know, because you have to be concerned about, you know, how that will affect your job here now that you've finally gotten a tenure track position here. So, that much on the TAA strike is kind of a self-correction about what happened there. After the strike ended, and it was, you know, the TAs stopped striking and went back to work because they were concerned about the end of the semester coming and how students might not be able to take final or get grades or credits and courses they'd taken in the spring. So out of a kind of a fundamental, you know, commitment to teaching and being, you know, reasonable to students, the TA stopped striking and went back to work. And this failed strike led the then chancellor, I believe it was Irving Shane, but don't hold me to it, to appoint a campus-wide committee to create a new set of teaching assistance policies and procedures, TAPP. And on this campus-wide committee was my German department colleague, Frank Gentry. I think he was tapped for it primarily to represent the humanities, not that he had a great role himself in writing the document. I think the policies and procedures were actually drafted by the university lawyers, and that the faculty members who were on the committee basically just discussed and in a way rubber stamped what the university lawyers had come up with. And that was the document that was in effect from, let's say, the time that it was finally completed during the school year 1980-81, that's when it was written, until I believe the mid-80s, for a span of approximately 4 years. That's when the state legislature passed legislation written by, you know, I think David Clarenbaugh, saying that they had to recognize the TA as a legitimate bargaining agent. If the, you know, the TAs would vote to form this union, which they did do by an overwhelming vote in 1985-86, as I read online. So that's kind of, the way that the German department was closely linked with the issues around the TAA and the second failed TA strike in 1980. Keeping in mind that Biddy Martin, graduate student, had been the chief member of the TAA, who had like represented it, the German department TAA members vis-a-vis the then department chair, Walters Nollendorf's, and that they were able to come to a remarkably good, somehow, political meeting of the minds, I think, you know, because she was not an extremist and was nonetheless, I think, representing graduate students brilliantly, quite well. Now, you know, also during these years, there were some interesting issues in the German department. I'll be getting to the gay stuff in a second, and somehow all this stuff is linked. For instance, as soon as I got here in 77, even, you know, in the years leading up to the strike, and then continuing after I was appointed here, I was involved with the organization called Women in German, WIG, WIG. And that was a national organization, and some of the key players, leaders, you know, in that organization were located right here at the UW-Madison. People like my colleague, senior colleague, Evie Beck, who had a split appointment in German and actually Complet and also Women's Studies, or graduate student Biddy Martin. And some of the older graduate students who were in the process of leaving Madison at that time, moving on, getting jobs, or, you know, finishing up their studies here, had also been involved in it. People like Pat Russian, and it was a kind of a good feminist organization, not really a lesbian feminist organization, but it wanted to bring about changes in the field of German studies so that, like, you know, women would get their due. It's interesting how much the profile of the field has changed in the past generation during the 33 years that I've been here, because now women are clearly the majority in the field of German studies. Among the professors, and especially the junior people who are coming up through the ranks and everything, there are far more women than men, and I believe it might be interesting to look at what the figures are in terms of like undergraduate majors and also graduate students enrolled in German. So, like a lot of these soft humanities fields as opposed to the hard sciences, no pun intended, there's been this shift toward a more presence of women. And they had like a whole variety of things which they wanted to do, picking up on the agenda of the general women's movement at that time. For example, they wanted to push the rediscovery of forgotten women authors, because it appeared that, like, you know, the texts that are considered important and canonic in German literature, Goethe, Schiller, and so on and so forth, all men writers. And so where are the women authors? Very few of them were represented in the curricula and the syllabi at that time. And so they wanted to help rediscover forgotten women writers. And I think they've had considerable success at that, not just the organization Women in German, but of course within the Germany itself, there was a kind of a feminist wave of scholarship that took place too. However, importantly then too, what they wanted to do was provide a kind of a mentorship to women in the field, especially people who were just hired, were assistant professors, and maybe needed support on the way up. Altogether, when I started, this kind of mentorship was unknown. Since then, it's become institutionalized, you know, in academia, that like junior professors, when they first start here, some senior colleague is appointed to be their mentor and to speak to them, you know, periodically about how they're doing and, you know, what they might consider doing slightly differently, or, you know, offer support and encouragement and tips and so on and so forth, so that the people don't feel that they're completely isolated. I mean, like some people would be able to find friends and allies on their own or informal mentors, but it's become formalized. It's a formalized procedure that's required, and not just at the UW-Madison, but I think nationwide. And partly that's in response to the way that the women in German wanted to do that kind of thing. And then like a cool thing that women in German was interested in was the how women are portrayed in German textbooks. For instance, we taught out of our Deutsch Heute textbook at the time that I started here. I think that's the correct one. And it's changed over the years many times. We sort of change textbook every 4 or 5 years. But like, it was typical of the textbooks of that era. It shows, you know, here's John, you know, these are easy sentences to learn in German. John likes to drive a sports car. Here's Betty. Betty likes to make cake, you know, and this kind of, you know, practice these sentences. Say this in German. Betty likes to make cake. John likes to drive a sports car. And so, you know, they wanted to kind of smash the stereotypes and kind of like open up the way, you know, change the way that women were portrayed in textbooks, less stereotypical. And that meant interactions with the national textbook publishers. This has been extremely effective, not just because of women in German and the way that like these German professors were in touch with the textbook publishers, but because at the same time there were similar trends going on in French and Spanish. I mean, there were feminist professors of Spanish, and they also hated the way the women were portrayed in the Spanish. So all the textbook publishers were getting hit from all sides by these things that they really had to kind of update these materials. And that's happened quite a bit. Incidentally, now let me tell you what the limits of tolerance and bring it right up to the present, because I'm describing what I did 33 years ago, joining this organization, Women in German, and here at the Madison branch of it. And I was actually the national treasurer for a few years, I see by looking on my resume, which meant, you know, people sent in their membership checks and I deposited them in an account we had here at the UW Credit Union. So I was kind of an officer of the organization for, where is it, Women in German. Whoops, I'll find this in a split second here. I'd have here editorial board, 1977 to 81. I was treasurer, and also on, we put out a little, you know, newsletter, which changed into a yearbook later. Well, so one of my colleagues currently in the German department is Monica Chavez, who also is a specialist in foreign language teaching, or German language teaching, say, to English language speakers, or to foreign speakers, you know, foreign non-German speakers in general. Second language acquisition. SLA. She's created the important graduate, interdepartmental graduate program in SLA, second language acquisition. And she's the co-author of an important textbook for first year German, Vorsprung, which means leap forward, you know, like great leap forward or something, like Mao Zedong. Well, anyway, Vorsprung is a very nice textbook. I've enjoyed teaching out of it. And it features the adventures of an American young lady who goes to Germany on a study abroad year. And chapter by chapter, you follow her through her months of being over in Germany and getting to know what life is like in the dormitory and what classes are like and going around town and visiting relatives. She has some German relatives in another city and everything. And Monica Chavez tells me that she and her co-authors of this textbook wanted to have a gay person in this book. They wanted one of her relatives in Germany to be a gay uncle, that she would go visit her gay uncle in Berlin. And, you know, it would be introduced in some way or another, you know, like, it's not that he would, you know, necessarily take her to the gay bars or anything like that, but like, this was nixed by the textbook publisher, which said, we love your textbook and we love what you're doing with, you know, everything about it, but there are limits to tolerance, and if we have a gay character in this textbook, the textbook probably would not be adopted at certain Bible colleges and so on and so forth. And so for the sake of the bottom line and American sensibilities, we just have to not have a gay character in this textbook. See, that's interesting. Don't you think that's interesting? Mm-hmm. I think that's quite interesting, that it's alive and well out there. Or you can see there, like, that it's still an issue what you can portray in a textbook, what's acceptable and what's not. Precisely in kind of a first-year German textbook, which is supposed to be a widely adopted nationwide, every place from military academies straight through to Bible colleges to state universities like ours and everything else in between. Okay, so that's about women in German. Let me say a little bit more about that. There were hardly any men in this organization, Women in German. I mean, maybe two nationwide. I knew because I was the treasurer. I had all the membership dues, you know, from everybody. And the notion was they had an annual meeting. And they still do. That organization is still in place and still has this annual national meeting and still puts out its yearbook. And the notion was I could potentially travel to attend this national meeting, especially since I was, you know, an officer and everything else. But I chose not to go based on a kind of a political or, you know, sexual political principle that I had at the time, which was around the notion of let women have women's space, let them be alone together. That's what a lot of people want to do. Maybe some people would feel constrained in what they might say if men were present and so on. And I was well aware of the fact that if you looked nationwide at the lesbian feminist movement, that there was at that time a powerful faction within the lesbian feminist movement which was separatist. And that was also true in Germany at that mm-hmm. time. Both in the United States and Germany, there was a powerful separatist tendency within the lesbian feminist movement. One simple manifestation of this, which was going on at that time, I believe, in the early 1980s, the Michigan Women's Music Festival. Now, you know, this is when they changed the spelling of women's to W-O-M-Y, and, you know, so they don't have men in it. Or, you know, at the time when here, community radio in Madison Wart, we had Sue Goldwoman as kind of the DJ for the Sunday show, her Infinite Variety, you know, the feminist show, mm-hmm. changes her name from Goldman to Goldwoman. And also what we had in Madison at that time was there was a powerful, out of Lysistrata and out of, will I be able to name this, an organization that existed at that time? There was an organization, lesbian organization in Madison, lesbian feminist organization, women's organization, that brought women's music to Madison. And these performers would play at different venues around town. Holly Neer and all, later Katie Lang, and all the, you know, national stars of the women's music circuit. And to some, and also there was this, the emergence of lesbian comedians at this time, and comedy shows. And some of the shows, this was written up in Isthmus at the time somewhere, were closed to men. Men were not allowed to buy tickets. And, you know, this is a kind of an interesting legal issue because these are supposed to be public spaces and whatnot. And I believe that some men went around to the box office and said, well, we want to get a ticket. You have to sell us a ticket. You know, we're going to go to court if you don't sell us a ticket. And, you know, then there was this discussion about, you know, what is the legal situation? Do you have to let men into your event or not? What do you do when men want to come around? I also want to make the point that at about this time, Biddy Martin got interviewed for the job as assistant dean in the deanery of the College of Letters and Science after having been a TA in the German department in women's studies for many times. She went to her interview committee, and one of the interview questions which was put to her, as she reported to us later, was, suppose you're offering a course on lesbian culture, which did exist in the program. I think it still exists, 310 or something like that, Women's Studies 310. Suppose you're offering a course on lesbian culture, and a man wants to sign up for the course. What do you do? Well, she answered the question exactly right and got the job. You know what I mean? Like, I don't even know what the right answer is, you know? Mm-hmm. I don't even know what she said, although she told me at the time what she'd said. But I kind of, I don't know, it's too far back in time. I think that, like, you know, what you would have to say, it seems to me, was, okay, you're certainly entitled to sign up for the course. Now, are you sure that this is the right thing for you? Let me tell you about, like, what we're going to do. I don't know. So, see what I mean? But this is an actual issue about excluding men from certain lesbian-focused activities. And so I had the possibility of attending the national annual conventions of Women in German, which jumped around the nation to different campuses year by year. And my position was always, no, let the women meet on their own. I don't even want to go. You know, they should have their own space. And some of my colleagues here, say Evie Beck in the German department, say, oh, come on, it doesn't make any difference. It'd be cool. You know, you'd be most welcome. And I said, you know, maybe I would be most welcome, but I still feel like there ought to be a space. In other words, I was kind of an advocate of separatism, even at that time. Now, you know, I was willing to put up with it. I think that, like, you know, it's politically incorrect and it's kind of a bad idea. It's a constitutional issue. It's a free association or whatever, free assembly issue. It's a public public places. You know, you can't turn people down based on, you can't bar people from going into a restaurant based on their sex or gender or something like that. And so how can you not let people go to a concert or a music festival? Very interesting question. I don't know. I'm not very smart about all of this. Maybe I would like to leave money to the UW-Madison and set up a scholarship that's for gay people. Is this even doable? Are you even allowed to do this? You know, they might say, no, we can't do that, you know. Mm. Although I've heard that there are like scholarships only for people of Norwegian ancestry or who hail from, you know, Hoboken or something like that. I mean, where do we draw the lines on these things? I'm not sure exactly. But, maybe they would interpret it that way this year, and in the future, you know, they'd change their mind legally about what they can do. Also at that time, there was the, you may not believe it, but it's true, the KKK came to Madison and wanted to appear on radio and talk shows and hold a rally and burn a cross on some intersection here in town. And the whole left community got mobilized around that. And it was kind of a free speech issue. And then they even went on, I think, Wart Radio, and then some people like picketed and protested and sat in at the radio station because they felt that they should not be giving the KKK a platform. And so, you know, related to all of this is kind of free speech issues, like what are you? Are you a civil libertarian? Are you totally in favor of free speech? Or are you going to limit the speech of, say, a hate speech? And eventually, of course, our own chancellor, Donna Shalala, would create that hate speech regulation for the UW campus, saying certain kinds of speech are banned on campus. You can't say the N-word in a lecture and who knows what. There are things that are hate speech. And this, it was thought that this had, you know, it obviously did have connections to the gay question. I'm jumping, pardon me, across issues in time by jumping way ahead to Donna Shalala. But I think that, like, these are kind of some of the legal issues that were thrown up by the LGBT question, the way it is on campus, having to do with, you know, men's presence at women's things, men enrolling in lesbian culture, what about hate speech on campus? And of course, that went all the way to the Supreme Court, paid for by, you know, Wisconsin taxpayers with UW lawyers going to the Supreme Court, where it was shot down, that you cannot limit speech in that way on campus. So. Civil liberties won in that case, and Donna Shalala was the one who was interesting to say no hate speech is allowed. I mean, that was the rule on campus for a number of years. Now we just have to put up with it when people are abusive, you know what I mean, say homophobic things or something like that, or racist things, mm-hmm. which they don't in a way. I mean, less and less. So that was WIG, let's say, Women in German. Yeah. Maybe that's enough on that. And as I look at my, I've written in my text here that some of the faculty members, here's a lesbian culture, Women's Studies 442, that existed at that time. That was taught by quite a few people, Evie Beck, Elaine Marx, whom I've already mentioned, Claudia Card, who was that philosophy professor, and later Mariamne Whatley of Curriculum and Instruction. She just retired last year. And It was also in this era, in the early 80s, around the time of, well, maybe, I don't have a precise date, maybe I have documents at home that show it, that we wanted to create a faculty gay group here on campus. There was a student gay group that existed, and we wanted to get something going that would, no faculty members attended the gay events and activities, generally speaking, put on by the gay student group. Well, there were these monthly dances that took place at the Union, and maybe occasionally a professor would drop by one of those dances or something, but not too much. And also, when talks were held, maybe there'd be a little bit of a turnout from some of the gay professors, but not too much. And so at that time, there was an out gay professor in the zoology department named John Kirsch. And he just died a year and a half ago and left a big wad of money to the Hoofers organization on campus, you know, the sailboat rentals and all that kind of stuff, because that was his big hobby. He was a wonderful man, John Kirsch was. He was a zoology professor and the head of the zoology museum on campus. It doesn't have a lot of attendance from the public. Did you know we have a zoology museum? It's kind of interesting. And I mean, I've always been kind of interested in zoology in a way. He was a terribly nice man and also quite brilliant. He'd been, prior to coming to Madison, a professor at Harvard. And maybe, do you know how it works in the academic world? They say that the Ivy League schools, the big ones, well, the really big ones, not the little ones like Cornell or Penn, but the big ones like, let's say, especially Harvard, and to some extent also Princeton and Yale, let's say, just confine it to those three, they create these revolving door positions for junior people, which means you're in and out. And the idea is they will bring in junior people fresh out of graduate school for maybe 3 years and then not extend their contract. You know, tell them they have to find a different job somewhere else. And often it's a good springboard to go from Harvard to some other place, because you obviously have to be good to get a job at Harvard in the first place. But in other words, the way that a school like Harvard maintains its high academic profile, it's a different approach here at the UW-Madison, exactly the opposite, is the way Harvard works is they only hire as tenured professors people who have an outstanding track record as a senior person somewhere else. A person who's already been in the field for 10, 15, 20 years and has published a raft of books and stuff that's regarded as world class, tops. And then you hire that person, you know, bring them in as a senior person. Those are your professors. And the junior people are all these people who are in these revolving door positions who are not going to stay there. That's what we call the revolving door approach. That's John Kirsch was one such. Whereas the approach here at the UW-Madison is we hire people who seem promising fresh out of graduate school. We bring them here and we groom them and we mentor them, new word, and help them and encourage them to publish by not giving them heavy service assignments for their years of probation. They can focus on just doing their teaching and doing their publications and don't have to do committee work. And in that way, you kind of groom people and tend people and raise them up through the ranks, and then you promote them to tenure and keep them, you know? So that's the, you know, those are the two basic approaches in a way hiring people. John was this outstanding professor, brilliant from Harvard, very well spoken, very well, he wrote beautifully, good English, very good writing. And he created this gay faculty group called Symposium. And the Symposium met at, you know, round robin fashion at the homes of different professors around town. Maybe because John Kirsch was a zoology professor, it seemed like the sciences were really strongly represented in it at that time. There was another zoology professor, John Neese, who just passed away about a year ago. Also Derek Bounds, who was a professor, I believe, of microbiology. I believe that's the right word for it. He's a specialist on eyes, nerves, and optic nerve, and brain, and how the brain picks up on eye messages. Also retired a few years now. And then like various other people from other departments, such as John Longress, who was a professor of social work. He could very usefully be interviewed for this project. I think he's living out in Portland, retired now. And professor of social work, and also am I going to say his name right? I want to say Charlie McCarthy was the professor of political science who died of AIDS subsequently. McCarthy. I need to, oh, excuse me. Charlie Gillespie, of course. I was thrashing around among Irish names there. You see what I mean? Okay. Charlie Gillespie. Who is Charlie McCarthy? He's that dummy, you know, mm-hmm. for ventriloquism. See? Yep.
That's Edgar bad. Bergen and Charlie McCarthy.
Exactly. Okay, so Charlie Gillespie. So sorry. So, and me, and then, I don't know, a handful of other professors from here and there. And the main activity of symposium, apart from holding these, you know, get-togethers at people's houses and talking, was to invite some speakers to campus. And a very important speaker that we invited was John Boswell. John Boswell was teaching out at Yale at that time. And he had authored this prize-winning book, Homosexuality in the Western Christian Tradition, published by the University of Chicago Press, very groundbreaking. And he was brought to campus and lectured here, a huge turnout in Burge Hall, filled the auditorium, big reception afterwards. And he talked about his forthcoming book, his research that he was doing about gay marriage in the Middle Ages. Boy, that was kind of prophetic when you consider what's being discussed now and what the issues are. Trying to prove that in the Middle Ages there had been a kind of a gay domestic union recognized by the Catholic Church, and that was then, you know, sort of trashed and forgotten later on and suppressed. So that was a very important lecture, very wonderful. John Boswell, unfortunately, subsequently died of AIDS. But at the time that he was here, we had a lovely reception for him, not just in the lobby of Burge Hall where he lectured, but also in the home of gay professors here on campus, or one gay professor, Andrew Seeler of the Linguistics Department. And his partner is John Tallman, who was one of the university lawyers on the top floor of Van Nuys there. And they have a fabulous house on Summit Avenue and University Heights there. So that was a very important reception. So that was a kind of a big deal at the time, a really huge deal, and taped and shown on TV and all this kind of stuff. Now, out of this group of people that I met through the group symposium, we created the first gay studies course here at the UW-Madison. And that was taught in 1987, and again 2 years later in 1989. So it took a while for us to do this, to figure out exactly what would be done. But what we wanted to do was, and when I say that it's the first gay studies course here on campus, that's a slight, or more than a slight misnomer, because there was already in place the course Lesbian Culture. Which was taught going back to, oh, I think about the time that I arrived here, about 77 or 76. And of course there were gay elements in gay components or lesbian components in other courses like the Introduction to Women's Studies and so on and so forth, especially in the Women's Studies department. But what we wanted to do was do something that would be not lesbian focused but kind of more broad. And we wanted to team teach. And so we had a cool, I thought, arrangement to do this in a kind of an informal way without creating, you know, this campus does not like team teaching. And it does not like interdisciplinary and cross-disciplinary, cross-departmental stuff. It's very hard to, much more than on other campuses nationwide. Much, much more. This campus, I don't know, is extremely pigeonholed and slotted. and never the twain shall meet among the different departments. And team teaching is extremely difficult to organize administratively and to get the approval of the dean. Like, one person will get credit and another person won't. And, you know, so in fact, this course on gay studies that we created in 1987 was an overload course. It was not recognized as teaching by the deanery. It was done in addition to the regular teaching. So I had my regular course load and then did this on top of it out of the goodness of my heart. And in fact, we did it twice that way, and then the other people who were involved in it said, I'm sick of this, I'm not going to do another course on an overload basis. We have to, you know, make it a real course and get it recognized as teaching, or it's just not going to happen. And in fact, it didn't happen in that format with the team teaching. But we had three guys doing it. I was supposed to represent the humanities, and initially Professor John Neese was supposed to represent science, and in the second iteration of it, it was Professor Derek Bounds who did the science part because John Neese retired. And John Longress of social work was supposed to represent the social sciences. And so we had a 15-week course in which 5 weeks was devoted to science, natural science, 5 weeks to social science, and 5 weeks to the humanities. Boy, I'll tell you, that's a quick survey, you know, of everything. But it had a nice, it had a pretty healthy enrollment. I mean, well, it wasn't overwhelming, but I think maybe 40 people turned out for it. And the deal was, it was listed in three different departments. Neese and Bounds, being in the zoology department, could list it as a directed study in zoology. John Longress, being in the social work department, they're right there, could list it as a one-credit direct. It was a one-credit course. No, wait a minute. No, I think it was a three-credit course. It was a 15-week course, so it's a three-credit course. But they were responsible for one-third of it. And each of us did like 5 weeks of this course. So it was a directed study in social work for the social work credit. Then for people who wanted to register in it for humanities credit, they had to register with me. Well, couldn't be in the German department. We don't have a gay course. And so I put it in women's studies. It was like the women's studies in humanities. I believe the course is like 330 or something like that. That, too, was like a bureaucratic leaping through hoops around the issue of separatism. I went to the Women's Studies and the Curriculum Committee and said, I want to offer this course. And they said, sounds interesting. And the main thing is that the Women's Studies Department at that time, program, not a department, program, called itself Women's Studies, and at a time when in the 80s at other schools they were changing their name to, for example, at Cornell University where Biddy was, well, subsequently Biddy was, it was called Feminism, the Department of Feminist Studies in Sexuality. Or something like gender and sexuality, feminist studies in gender and sexuality. It's a little broader, you know what I mean? And there was a complete resistance in the women's studies program here for many years to changing. Now they've changed. I don't know the precise year, but they changed it to gender and women's studies. Gender, yeah, and GWS, gender and women's studies. It took years, and it took the death of the founders of the program in a way. Who were like, we're going to go on this women's studies, you know, forever. This is this kind of separatist impulse, you know what I mean? So in other words, it was somewhat controversial and somewhat difficult for me to be able to teach a course in women's studies on gay studies, which was not going to be about lesbianism, it was going to be about men as well as women and so on and so forth. And, you know, I was kind of like grilled and interrogated by this curriculum committee of women's studies, and eventually they green-lighted it. I never got the inside skinny on how that discussion went. I have no agent inside women's studies who would be indiscreet and tell me what was going on. But that was, it was questionable. The students really liked what we did with that course, and as a result, it's interesting that students who were enrolled in that were like a blend of gay and straight and what we would now call Q, queer, questioning, you know, uncertain. And it's also, this is what happens nationwide when you do any of these gay studies courses. Quite a few people are motivated to go into it because maybe they have a family member who's mm-hmm. gay. Mm-hmm. Like you get these SADs, to some extent, kids who, you know, have been told by their dad 1 year earlier that their dad has decided that he's gay after, you know, he's going to break up the marriage. And like, you know, the 20-year-old kid is like shocked by all of this and saying, what the hell is going on? And so trying to get informed and educated, you know, in general about what gayness is, this kind of thing. And then of course, you have this constituency that are kind of these flamboyant queens and, you know, people who want to, you know, put on a show in every class. And then you have your, like, transgender people, like people who are being operated on and are halfway through in their sex change from female to male, or perhaps in the opposite direction, you know. And so your various, you know, motorcycle butch women taking it. So one interesting thing that goes on is it's a completely mixed constituency in which people are coming with all kinds of different levels of knowledge and background and what they want to find out. And some people know everything, and some people are shocked by what they learn, you know, in the course, and, you know, horrified by it and kind of mortified by sex practices that they learn about and everything. It's always kind of a stretch. It's always kind of a difficult thing to bring a group of people like that together. But it worked very nicely, I think. I think those other teachers who were involved in it were outstanding and, you know, presented interesting material, readings, and had good discussions and so on. And the roughly 40 students who were in it each time really liked it a lot. As a result, one thing that was going on in I'm naming years 1987 and 89, the two times this course was given. By the second time we gave it, a thing was going on campus, a little movement to create a gay fraternity. Yeah. What did they call themselves? They had Greek letters. I forget exactly what the name of it was. But they never did have a frat house. But they did create this gay fraternity of about five guys. And there were some chapters of it at other schools. And so this was also a time of questioning about, you know, where do gay people want to live? Do they want to live with each other? That's an issue that's with us very much right now, where we have these kind of special interest dorm units, and they're trying to create one around gender, maybe. They are nervous about doing it because it's so controversial. But that was already, you know, with this gay fraternity, there was this issue about how gay people live together and interact with one another in their free time back in the 1980s. And those fellas who were actually fraternity members in the course arranged it so that I got a teaching award from the Interfraternity Council. And they liked the course so much that they thought I should get an award for a faculty appreciation award from the Interfraternity Council. Isn't that amazing? A gay fraternity? Who knew? So I also want to make a point about what was going on with the mentality of these gay students in the gay studies course in 87, 89. I was so amazed at that time that the students' outlook was so different from mine. It was like a generational difference. Was like, for the first time, I mentioned to you previously that when I first arrived here, I identified more with the students than with the faculty members, because I was about the same age as the graduate students, and I'd been a graduate student for many years, and I was hardly a professor at all, or had been a professor for 1 week or 1 month. And also, my status as faculty was highly tentative the first 2 years because I didn't have a tenure track position. So why should I identify with these faculty members? But like, okay, so we're 10 years on, 87, 10 years on, my 10th year here at the Big U, and that's when I really felt this difference between me and the young gay people, and that came about in these discussions that we had in class. Because, to bring it to a, you know, to one point, which I will expand, but the one point is, boys and girls in the course, 18 and 19 years old, young men and young women, they said, well, of course I want to have a family, and of course I expect to have children. And I go, boing. And I looked at these other professors that I was teaching it with, you know, and we go, boing, you know, John Neese in social work and, excuse me, in zoology, and John Longress in social work, both of them lifelong bachelors, you know what I mean, no kids. And for me, part of the whole issue about coming out had always been, if you go gay, if you like cave and say, yes, I'm gay, what that means is you are consigning yourself to a life where you will never have children, which is kind of a shame, you know, kind of a pity, kind of a too bad, you know, because it's part of the human experience to raise a family and so on. That would be very interesting and, you know, worthwhile. And so, you know, to come out as a gay person had, for me, out of my generation from the late 60s, coming out in the summer of 1967, meant, okay, this means no kids. Now, of course, one thing that we've become aware of over time is that there were so many gay dads, you know, who were married who then came out. Mm-hmm. Or there were so many lesbian moms mm-hmm. who had been married. And also, this was the whole time when there was a lot of exploration about, well, you know, artificial insemination, like a lesbian couple can get a sperm donor and have, you know, a baby. Why not? And I actually entered some little negotiations with a lesbian couple here in town at that time about becoming a sperm donor. But I didn't do it. I kind of backed out of it for a variety of reasons. But part of it was that they would not have wanted me to be involved in the upbringing of this kid. They would have had this kid on their own. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So that, I mean, it would be one thing to be an anonymous sperm donor, but to kind of know that there's this kid out there of these people and that it's yours, it would be kind of strange, you know what I mean? It lacked anonymity, and yet it didn't include involvement. But I knew other people in town at that time who were involved in these experiments with maternity and paternity as gay people and as lesbians and gay men. But like, it seemed like to a man and a woman, these students in the class all said, well, of course, you know, I'm going to organize my life in some way so that I can end up being a parent. This is going to happen. And I was thinking to myself, well, I thought to myself, this is unrealistic. You haven't grasped yet what it means to be gay. That shows just how naive you are. You know, and yet at the same time, the more I thought about it, the more I realized, well, of course they can do it if they really want to, you know, and it signaled to me this whole different understanding of, you know, what gayness might mean and even the politics of gayness. You know, so like 2, 4, 6, 8, smash the family, smash the state, and now we've got this 2, 4, 6, 8, gay is just as good as straight, and we're going to have families too, you know, and kind of shifting the terrain in a way. And all of these issues around family, parenthood, whether lesbian parents can keep custody of children, there were all these custody battles that took place in court at this time. Well, there was actually an appointment here at the UW-Madison of a professor who unfortunately has left in the meantime, Professor Jane Schachter in the law school, a lesbian who taught a course on sexual orientation in the law. So that was really cool, dealing with all these issues around family and free speech and many kinds of interesting issues. Since I'm up to 1987, I have to look at myself here for a second and see what I'm doing. Yeah, I should say that, like, I was promoted to tenure in 1986, which is to say 1 year. I was tenured when I taught that gay studies course. And I think that had something to do with it, you know, having the job security. It's interesting that during the first years when I was here, my gay colleague, Evie Beck, my lesbian colleague, who, you know, said, sure, come to the WIG meetings, or sure, I'll take you to the gay bar, and through her I met my later roommates, Jacob Stockinger and so on. Evie spoke at one of these conferences that we held, maybe it was connected with the German department, or I think it was actually more one of these things about lesbian and gay studies on campus. And she said that she would advise a graduate student in German, Biddy Martin was one such, not to come out of the closet until they were promoted to tenure. In other words, to be conceal your gay identity during the time that you are untenured. And I'm just making a note to myself here. About something I'll say later. Well, I'd already broken that rule, you know. I mean, it might be that it was a sensible rule, but I was out of the closet, so to speak, when I was hired here. And yet, I had a kind of a complex status because what I was trying to do in the first years that I was here was get my record ready to be promoted to tenure, my publication record. And I did some straight publishing and some gay publishing, a little bit of both. And so I was actually violating Evie Beck's, you know, safety rule, which I think was, you know, very, you know, somewhat appropriate for the time. But she too was to some extent of a different generation. You know, she had a different outlook. She had been married for a number of years to Professor Anatole Beck here. She had adult children, well, you know, college age children. One of her son, Mika Beck, took German with me here at the UW-Madison. He was a wonderful computing science major, and I think he's now some kind of a computer guru. He's very excellent in his field. So she had had this complex way of coming out and struggling with her identity, and I had done it much quicker in my life, you know, at age 20. I think she was more like age, I don't know, I'd take a stab and say age 40 or something like that. No, age 30, 35. So she was even more cautious in her outlook than I was. And promotion to tenure in 1986 had a couple of outcomes. One of them was that I taught this gay studies course in the spring in 1987. And then in the fall of 1987, I was able for the first time to go abroad and teach abroad because I had to stay here at the UW-Madison up until the time that I had, you know, a tenured rank. And so in the fall of 1987, for the first time, I went over to Berlin and taught as an exchange professor in Berlin. And there, I also had a gay studies course that I taught over there. Actually, a couple of gay studies courses that I taught in Berlin. Here I'm making a note to myself. And that was also a somewhat daunting experience teaching. I'd already gone through this, experience of teaching gay studies here to this very mixed constituency, a group of 40 students, but I shared the responsibility with two other professors and was really covering just 5 weeks of teaching. And then when I went to Berlin in the fall, I taught this course that I think had an enrollment of about 70 or so in a kind of a German gay literature course. That was very challenging because once again you have this whole array of different interests and different levels and straight people taking it, trying to figure out what's going on for various reasons, family members or whatever, questioning, queer questioning, gay people, and so on. And so it was kind of a very interesting and complex group to hold together. Also, there was in Germany, much more than in the United States, but I knew it from having been a student there, a kind of a rebelliousness on the part of the students and a kind of challenging authority much more than students do here. Here students are very good. They don't question authority. I wish they would question authority more. But like they do their assignment and they get their work done and so on and so forth and are accustomed to being on a certain kind of a schedule. And the Germans are much more all over the place and chaotic. So that's holding a group like that together is kind of difficult. Like when you've arranged for somebody to give a report on a given day and then they just don't show up, you know. So what are you going to do? So you always have to have a backup plan for everything, you know what I mean? You can't not have a backup plan for every single minute of the class, and you have to expect people to sort of challenge you and sass you in the classroom in various ways and tell you that you're an asshole and, this kind of stuff. So that's academic life in Germany. And I knew it well from my own school years, so that was quite interesting. And incidentally, some of the students who were in that class are still very interesting. One's a professor in Los Angeles now. One's a big gay author in Germany. And it's interesting to see, you know, what's happened with the students who came out of that course, a kind of a mixed bag. So 87 is like teaching gay studies in Madison and in Germany. Aha. Also, during this time, around my promotion to tenure in the year in the spring of 1986, that's when this ROTC thing here on campus kicks off. We finally arrived at ROTC. Well, we had this gay professors group symposium, and that was kind of important. We were having discussions within symposium about whether we should open it to graduate students or students in general, and whether it made any sense to just confine it to faculty members. And to tell you the truth, I was myself more in favor of keeping it as a faculty group. But I could see the arguments in favor of, you know, opening it up to graduate students at least. But I thought that the undergraduates had their own group and their own area for, you know, their activities with the campus gay group, and was not so much in favor of this. I thought it would like kind of make the mission or program of Symposium 2 diffuse. And what happened was that, like, I was basically outvoted or overruled, and it did open up and thereby became more diffused and eventually just kind of dissolved in a way. I think it only had an active life of a few years. But nonetheless, we had set up a kind of a network of faculty, and that was extremely helpful, not just in terms of setting up this gay studies course here, but also in terms of mobilizing faculty around the ROTC issue on campus. There was the main person who was behind all of this was, of course, the undergraduate student Rick Villasenor, who subsequently got an LGBT Distinguished Alumni Award because of the work that he had done in that. And we created an organization called UW Faculty Against Discrimination in University Programs. And Joe Elder in the sociology department was heading that up. It was extremely useful because I hope you've interviewed Joe Elder or soon will?
Soon will.
Okay. You know, because of his Quaker background, he, you know, with a kind of a pacifist, so to speak, outlook, you know, the Quakers and the military and everything, he'd always had a kind of a pronounced position on the military. And also had this kind of social activism that comes from his background and also from the church background and everything. So he was a highly respected professor here on campus, well known, who was a perfect person to head up our UW Faculty Against Discrimination. And he said, well, where are, you know, the other gay faculty? I said, well, here we are, I can name them off one after the other. And so we started off by getting a petition. You had to, we looked at the UW rules, and Rick Villasenor looked at the rules and found out that it's possible to call a meeting of the faculty to deliberate on an issue by getting the signatures of, don't hold me to this, I'd have to read the old newspaper clippings in the Cardinal on this, you know, 10% of the faculty, you have to get 10%, or something like that, you know, a certain percentage of the faculty has to sign a petition to do that. So we drafted this petition and then took it around and networked as best we could through our, you know, gay symposium group and in the different departments and everything, and got together all of the needed signatures. So it was on December 4th, 1989, we had the first meeting of the full faculty since the Vietnam War era. And took place at the Stock Pavilion right over there. And that's a building I hadn't been in up to that time, you know, but it was, we needed a big space to pull all those people together. And it was, oh, it was, wow, you know, it was like amazing because, you know, you had your ROTC supporters who wanted to keep the gay people out, people in uniform like crazy speaking, and the officers from ROTC, and the university lawyers. And then they got this student group represented by David, well, anyway, our campus group, the 10% Society, you know, they wanted to have one student representative speak, the president of that, David, early Alzheimer's. He had to give a little speech presentation. He came to me and said, I don't know what to say. I'm freaked out. I'm so nervous. So I wrote his speech for him, ghost writing, this kind of stuff. And I'm so close to saying his last name. All of these presenters, all of these speakers, and wow, it's historical, you know, you can look it up online, if by a vote of 386-248, the meeting of the faculty asked the Board of Regents to dismantle its contracts with ROTC, giving them a time frame of 4 years to unwrap that. And Donna Shalala, our then chancellor, said to the press, I didn't say to me, I wasn't within hearing distance when she said it, but it was all quoted in the paper that day, that she was proud of the faculty for voting that way. She invited us subsequently over to dinner at her house a couple weeks after that to kind of, you know, touch base and figure out what was going on. By us, I mean, the gay faculty who were involved with this, John Neese and John Kirsch and John Longress and myself, these people who taught the gay studies course. Well, you know, we made national news with that, and also these, petitions and demonstrations and so on. It was getting to be on the national news, and the UW-Madison was kind of the first one out of the gate on this thing, but it spread in a sort of wildfire fashion to certain other campuses where there were similar protests going on, including at Harvard, so that it's now being discussed apropos of this nominee, Kagan, for the Supreme Court, who took a position on that. And our committee, with Joe Elder as chair, also met with Wisconsin Congressman Les Aspin. He's not from Madison, he's from the 1st District south of here. But you know, he was also head of the House Armed Services Committee at that time. And I remember our meeting was over at the hotel on Old University Avenue. And well, all of this was shot down within a few months by the Board of Regents, which ruled that since the UW-Madison is a land-grant college, we have to offer military training. And they couldn't think of any way to set up military training other than through ROTC. Mm-hmm. So they said that it was simply illegal. The chancellor at that time was Shalala, and the congressperson from not our district, but from, who was, I think at that time, Kastenmeier, but from south of us, Les Aspin from the 1st District. Both Shalala and Aspin left Wisconsin in 93 to join the Clinton cabinet. And she was the Secretary of Health and Human Services, and he was the Secretary of Defense. And so Aspin was the person who basically worked out, together with Clinton, the Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy. So this is also forged out of this, it was a kind of a concession to the grassroots movement about the status of gays in the military. And you know, all this is, apropos of all this, I could say I was raised in a military family, you know, and I've never been that impressed with the military or, you know, kind of overwhelmed to sort of take it for granted a little bit. And I also didn't serve during the Vietnam era because I didn't want to go and was kind of, you know, opposed to the war. And it's very, I found it like passing strange to have to be involved in this thing to get gays into the military. See what I mean? Or not discriminated against by the military. But I applied my dialectical wisdom that I had learned from Biddy Martin, which is you have to like do things on a tactical level in order to bring about your strategic thing in the long term and everything. So we have to go through this kind of equal rights thing now to move to some bigger social transformation in the future. Okay, so I accepted that. You know, at that time, I also got to know pretty well the graduate student here on the UW campus named I should have prepared for this a little bit better. He's now a professor at Edgewood College of History. And he was, he'd been discharged from the military because of gayness. He'd been a Green Beret and got discharged on grounds of gayness, and he's written a book about that, a memoir. And, I'm getting very close to being able to produce his name for you. This will come to me. incidentally, I now remember the name of the student whose speech I wrote. That was Dave Wilcox. See, one at a time, these names do come. And this is Jay, and the history professor is Jay, kind of embarrassing. But anyway, it was interesting to have a person on campus here as a graduate student in history who was able to testify about what it meant to be dishonorably discharged from the military, and who wrote his memoir about being kicked out as a Green Beret. This brings us up to 1989, which is the time when we created the Gay and Lesbian Issues Committee. Also, I want to emphasize that 1989 was the year that the Berlin Wall fell. Remember? That was amazing. I was so confounded by this. I mean, like, I know that this interview is not about, it's supposed to be about the university, it's not supposed to be about the Berlin Wall or German politics or something like that. But I had this very odd sensation of, like, you know, becoming a kind of a news fanatic for the last months, weeks leading up to the time that the wall fell, because it was, everyone was watching it constantly on television, and it seemed like it was, you know, the way the system frayed and came apart, and, you know, people, waves of people going to Prague and going across to West Germany on trains, and like, would the East Germans call out the army to shoot at their own people? And this kind of nuttiness, it was just amazing. It totally dominated the news everywhere, radio and TV, having visited Berlin many times during the 1980s, during the summer, going back and forth across the wall and everything, subsequently applied for my secret police file from East Germany. And it took them a while, but they sent me just a few Xerox pages. I was kind of disappointed because the secret police file had only to do with my short visits there in the 1980s to East Berlin and East Germany, and had nothing to do with the year that I had spent there in 75, 76. I mean, how can you spend a whole year there and be under surveillance and there's no record of it, you see? And then be there, you know, just for these like sporadic one-day visits or something in the 1980s. And what it was the record of the 1980s says, you know, in contact with Dr. Otto André in Leipzig, involved with the gay movement. So that's, I was like observed by the East German secret police as being a kind of a gay movement activist and having contacts. I think maybe Otto André in Leipzig might have been the person who kind of squealed on me or whatever. I think that's the notion. But I also knew these other gay activists in East Berlin and so on and so forth. I think they didn't squeal on me, but I don't care. Go ahead and squeal on me. As for the documents that would pertain to my having spent a year there in the mid-70s, I assume that they are probably in the hands of the CIA. because, you know, it was, well, it was reported in the press and, you know, the New York Times and American Press, Washington Post and everything, that when the wall came down, the CIA agents swooped in there and grabbed up and bought, to some extent, early documents. And I think the ones that they would be especially interested in are the ones having to do with Americans in East Germany, you know, early on. And so I did also apply under the Freedom of Information Act to the CIA, asking them to, you know, give me any files that they had on me. And they wrote back and said that they didn't have any, but they cover that stuff up. Sometimes they have things and they don't tell you, you know what I mean? So we'll see, you know, what comes of all that in the future. I would be interested. I think, you know, over time, maybe they would be willing to hand out stuff. And I'd like to see what they took down in the 1970s. But anyway, the wall coming down, wow, that sure turned my world upside down in a way. You know, I'm kind of the Marxist, you know what I mean? And it seems like the world collapse of Marxism on a world historical scale. And I had this odd sensation. For some reason, I had to go to the hospital on that day. You know, that was November 9th, 1989. And November 9th is a very easy day to remember in German history because it also marks, November 9th is also the day when World War I ended. It was the armistice in World War I, the German defeat, you could say. And it was also the pogrom, the Reichskristallnacht, when they burned the synagogues in 1938. So November 9th is like marked three ways, you know, in German history. And for some reason, I had to go to the UW hospital. And I forget whether I, you know, had injured myself or exactly what the deal was. But I was out there at the university hospital, sitting there in the waiting room, in the emergency room, waiting room. And I'm watching TV, which is there in the lobby, and you see these people climbing up on top of the wall, and the reporter saying, the Berlin Wall is down. People are crossing the line. What? You know, I must be hallucinating. I can't believe it, you know. This just blows my mind. Oh, I should also say that at that time, I was interviewed on public radio, as were certain other people in the German department, or people knowledgeable about German politics, such as Professor Mel Krohn, whom we had in the poli-sci department at that time, who was the author of a book on Moscow's German ally, the GDR. So he was an expert on East Germany who was, you know, interviewed on TV, on the radio here. And I was interviewed on public radio about, you know, what would happen with Germany at the time that the wall was coming down. Naturally, I made some kind of rash pro-Marxist statements, you know what I mean, pro-communist statements, and with the result that, like, I had an interesting set of threatening telephone calls that came to me at that time around the Germany issue. Yeah. So you have to be careful what you say, you know what I mean? But, of course, there's a lot of huffing and puffing on the telephone that doesn't really amount to anything in the long run. But I was really shocked by the collapse of the Berlin Wall. You know, life was changing rapidly. Well, as I mentioned, it was in 1989, the year when the wall came down, that the Dean of Students, Mary Rouse, signaled that she was going to support LGBT interests by founding the Gay and Lesbian Issues Committee, which was GLIC. And I think that Mary Rouse's motivation to, has she been interviewed as well? She definitely needs to be interviewed, both for her work as Dean of Students, you know, just generally for the university. She saw it all. She was like right in the cockpit, you know, for many years, and has quite a bit to say, quite a bit to contribute, and then also has quite a bit to contribute on LGBT issues. Oh, by the way, back up. I was trying to come up with the name of that professor who was discharged as a Green Beret, dishonorably discharged, and is now a professor at Edgewood College. Jay Hathaway was his name. So he could be interviewed too as an alum. He knows quite a bit about these things. Well, Mary Rouse wanted the Gay and Lesbian Issues Committee to come up with a kind of a general report about what ought to happen on campus here. I think that she was responding in part to the stuff about ROTC and the way that had been shot down, and it seemed like, you know, the gay movement was kind of like discredited on campus or weaker, and so this is a way of kind of bolstering it. And we had some excellent people involved in that committee. Kevin McIntyre was a staff member here on campus who took over organizing this whole array of meetings that we had. I think we met on a weekly basis for a couple of years, and we had like these focus groups and public hearings, and met with all kinds of campus representatives of different offices and agencies and so on. And so after 2 years, we were able to put together a report that was issued in January 1992. And that is, you know, still available online. And it recommended, among other things, that we should have a half-time staff person within the Dean of Students office to serve as liaison to the LGBT student community. And we also called for the establishment of an LGBT campus center and for the development of a gay and lesbian studies program. And so fortunately, and to some extent, all three of those things have happened in the meantime. And the first person who was assigned out of the Dean of Students office to be the liaison to the LGBT campus community was Assistant Dean Janice Shepherd. She got that appointment in 1992. That was, our report was issued in January 1992, and that year she got that part-time position, which we'd called for a 50% position. And it took 7 years, but 7 years later it became a full-time position. It got upgraded. And we also opened up the LGB Campus Center in 1992, first in an off-campus location up by the Capitol building, by the Capitol Center, and then briefly on campus in a tiny office, a broom closet really in the Memorial Union. It was kind of a disgrace. And then at two more off-campus locations, and then finally in 1998 in its current place. So that's been, you know, it's taken time to get established, and that was somewhat controversial about how much space are we supposed to be giving these people, you know? And also, I remember the debates about whether it would be located, since the Red Gym was supposed to be the place for new students, visitors to campus, visitor center, since moved to 21 North Park or whatever it is. The visitor center there in the Red Gym. We can't have the LGBT office in the Red Gym because then the visitors to campus, the newcomers, the parents would see it. You know what I mean? And they would think, what is this, some kind of a haven for homos, this campus? What is going on here? You know? So these are some of the issues. It's interesting that, like, although Mary Rouse really advanced this and really pushed gay rights and everything, there was a strong perception on the part of students involved in the campus gay group that she was actually foot dragging on it. I don't think so. I think that was a misperception. But things could not go fast enough for these people. But it'd be very interesting to talk to Mary Rouse about, you know, to what extent, you know, she saw herself as being a trailblazer and a pioneer, and to what extent, you know, how she responded to the student criticism of her, of not being, you know, not being a vigorous enough advocate of LGBT issues at the time. Well, since I have to weave my career bits together in a kind of a complicated way here, keep doing this. Prior to our issuing that report in 1992, I spent another semester teaching over in Germany on a faculty exchange. And this time it was the spring of 1991, I taught in Hanover. And that was very interesting. Once again, I taught a big course on gay literature, German gay literature. I had a very interesting group of students. And that was a really nice time. I really thought the students were more respectful than in Berlin. They're kind of more cooperative, more willing to work, not so anti-authoritarian and so on, not so chaotic as in Berlin, more provincial and kind of hardworking. And it was also very interesting That was Gulf War number one against Saddam Hussein because he'd invaded Kuwait. It was so interesting because just before I headed off for Germany to go to that semester of teaching in Hanover, I was once again like watching TV, the whole country was watching TV as we saw these pictures of these missiles streaking through the night and hitting Baghdad, you know, in 91, nighttime, you know, and all these flares and missiles and anti-aircraft. Good grief, you know. And as I recall, maybe, was it that one? Was it that trip? I think so. When I was flying over to Germany to begin this job, the airline pilot gets on the thing and says, just wanted to give you a news update that Israel has now positioned its anti-missile rockets and they are preparing to be shot at by the Arab countries and everything, which they were, and then they used these American anti-missile rockets and everything. So, oh my God, you know, it's kind of war, big time. And I got to Germany and there were all these peace demonstrations going on. Well, look, there had been peace demonstrations here. You know, I'd left Madison where there were peace demonstrations going on and arrive in Germany where there are these giant peace demonstrations that they say were, you know, across the country, tens of thousands of people making a human chain across the bridge in Frankfurt, you know, and they all have these candles and this kind of stuff and they say, peace, peace. And I arrived at the campus office that I was to occupy and there was a graffiti sprayed on it saying, Yankees scram, get out of here. Mm. And you know, so it's interesting, you know, the German policy. The then German Chancellor, Helmut Kohl, from the right-wing party, from the Christian Democratic Union, made a statement to the press about 1 week after I'd arrived in Germany. And he made a policy statement for Germany. He said, I want these demonstrations against the war in Germany to stop. America is our ally. And Germany is going to back up America on this. The demonstrations stopped instantly. It was so amazing. I thought, these Germans are such authoritarian jerks. You know, all it takes is some statement from the head of their government to tell them to stop demonstrating, and they do it. You know, I just couldn't believe it. I just could not believe it, the kind of pacification that had taken place in Germany, you know. Of course, he was busy celebrating German unification and this kind of stuff. He was the unification chancellor. Very irritating. I was kind of annoyed with the Germans on that. And then I also remember watching on TV these shows, they say, parents, my children are crying all night. They're so upset about the war. They can't get any sleep. They're afraid. My children say to me, Mommy, are the bombs going to drop on us in Germany? What's going to happen? You know, my child is having a complete trauma. And I'm thinking to myself, if that child is having a trauma, it's because you, the parent, have traumatized that child. You know, what are you saying? You know, what the hell's going on? Kids wouldn't even know this. You know, so anyway. Very strange, this kind of whiny obedience of the Germans, in a way. Well, anyway, that's bad. That's kind of nasty of me. It was Nietzsche who talked about Völkerpsychologie, the psychology of different nations. The psychology of the German nation is sometimes this whiny obedience, you know. The strange thing about being away in Germany, and once again teaching this gay course to a mixed group of students and everything, was in part that I had, that I was away from the work of the Glick for one semester. And this going away from these organizations, going to Germany for a semester, is always kind of a problem because it's, it's hiatus. And kind of lose the thread and have to get back into it and everything. And that's accompanied me quite a bit over the years, that problem of going to Germany. It's going to happen again next year when I go. Well, when I came back to Madison after having been in Hanover for a year, I was presented with a couple of interesting changes. One was, as a fait accompli, I was told when I came back, oh, by the way, you're going to be book review editor of our journal now. Boom. You know, okay, I ended up doing that for 5 years, from 91 to 96. I was kind of slightly, how should I put it, kind of annoyed in the German department because it was just a lot of extra work. And when I stepped down in 96 from that job, the next person who got it was under the condition that that person would get a course release. You see what I mean? Teach one course fewer per year. I had no course release. You know what I mean? I'm kind of pissed off that now that it's set up in that way. I mean, it should have been set up that way for me too. But it wasn't. No, I was just told, okay, do this. I never asked to do it, never raised my hand saying I want to do it. I didn't want to do it. I was just told I had to do it. Furthermore, I was told that I had to do it by a person who was instantly departing Madison and was gone, this aforementioned right-winger Frank Gentry, who had taken a job at Penn State as the head of the German department out there. And, you know, in subsequent years, there was always this notion, will Frank Gentry want to return to Madison? And will he, you know, in retirement want to return to Madison? He might want to yet. It was an important position that he got out there at Penn State. He had served as chair of the German department at the UW-Madison, and that's, you know, the served as head of the, or our committee person on the teaching assistance policies and procedures tab. And he got this position as head of the German department out at Penn State. And the way he explained it to me was that here at the UW-Madison, the department members elect vote on the chair. But out there at Penn, there is no vote. It's not democratic, and instead the head of the department is simply named by the dean, and there is no voting, you know. And furthermore, the head of the department is kind of like the dictator of the department and sets, for example, teaching assignments and so on and so forth, just based on doing it here. Boom, this is your job. So a more, you know, king of the department, it could be called, much less democratic than the procedure here. And apparently that very much agreed with him. You see what I mean? That's the kind of thing that he likes to do, is kind of call the shots. Well, it was also at this time when I got back that we created the Gay, Lesbian, and Bisexual Alumni Council. And, you know, the key people who were involved in founding that, I mentioned them in a previous interview with you, with Dick Wagner and Tammy Baldwin and others. And initially, it was just sort of going on its own, and then it affiliated with the Wisconsin Alumni Association in 94. And that organization wanted to, you know, do what it could to encourage an LGBT presence on campus, and also created the Distinguished Alumni Award. And the first one was presented in 94 as a memorial tribute to the deceased Ruth Blyer, who'd been a scientist here, a natural scientist, and George Stambolian. You know, George Stambolian is the one who has this video interview about the purge of 1962. Mm. And at that time, he was recently deceased of AIDS. That was 92. After having given this report to Dean Mary Rouse that we ought to have a gay and lesbian studies program, Mary Rouse said to us, well, you know, I'm just the dean of students. I'm not an academic dean. I mean, I have to do with the campus life, you know, with the quality of life on campus and keeping things on an even keel. But academic things have to be pursued in a different way. So I decided that what we ought to do is create a new committee structure that could push gay studies on campus. And we poked around a little bit and had a first meeting, I believe, with Gary Sandifer, who was a dean, an associate dean at that time. And now he's, you know, dean of the College of Letters and Science. And I'm making a note to myself. So he said that a good approach would be to take our proposal to the university committee, which is the top faculty committee here at the UW-Madison, and they function to some extent to propose the creation of other committees. So we worked up a proposal and got it signed, petition-like, by a large number of people, and went before university committee. When I say we, I mean especially Janice Shepherd from the Dean of Students Office and myself. and proposed that we wanted to set up a new committee, not a Dean of Students committee, but a new committee campus-wide to address lesbian, gay, and bisexual issues. And they proposed, they gave it their, signed off on it and said, this sounds like a good idea to us. And so 2 months later, I spoke to the Faculty Senate here in May 94 and said that we wanted to create the UW-Madison GLB Issues Committee as a standing faculty committee, and with the mission of fostering relevant teaching and research and coordinating those very difficult interdepartmental efforts, bringing departments together, so hard to do on this campus, organizing conferences, and also gathering information and considering concerns about discrimination and career advancement and mentoring. That was all in, I just told you the year, that was in 1994. 8 years later, we added the T, so we became LGBT instead of LGB. And so, sure enough, the Faculty Senate voted to set up this committee. And one of the first things that we did was, we met in the fall, I was the chair of the committee, and Claudia Card was involved, and Mariamne Watley, and Joe Elder from the ROTC effort, and so on and so forth. One of the first things that I thought would be useful to do is to try to figure out how strong or weak gay studies is on campus here. And so I wanted to conduct a, I proposed that we conduct a survey. And we went to the faculty secretary in Bascom Hall, and they said, yes, since you are a standing committee, that means you are authorized to get a mailing list, mailing labels for all the professors, all the teaching people on campus. You can do that. We can mail it out. We have a budget for that. So we created this survey form, you know, which said basically, do you ever teach a course that has any gay content? If so, how much? Describe it. And are you aware of anything, you know, gay related that's ever gone on in your department, like discrimination against gay people or anything like that? And are you interested in LGBT things? If we had conferences, would you be interested in participating? So it's like this two sides of one page. And sent it out to 2,000 people. And we got a reasonably good return. And so we were able to create a list of approximately 100 courses campus-wide that had some gay content. Admittedly, it was very rare to have a course that was 100% gay content, such as the lesbian culture course. Most of them, you know, just had like 1/10 of the course had some gay content. But, you know, there were a lot of people who expressed an interest in the matter, you know, not signaling simultaneously that they were gay or anything or lesbian, but just, you know, that they wanted to have more or thought that it was worthwhile to introduce this stuff. And in a whole slew of departments across campus, you could hardly even imagine that this would be represented. So it was quite encouraging to see how strong, you know, the presence of gay stuff in the curriculum already was. And I believe another important member of the committee was Professor Janet Hyde, who teaches this course on human sexuality. That's got a big gay component in it and everything. So she'd be another very important person to interview about these issues. But at this point, I left and went to Germany for a year. to Freiburg, exactly the same thing I'm going to be doing this coming year. That was the school year 96-97 that I was going to Freiburg. And so we had to find a new chair of this faculty committee, and that turned out to be Richard Keeling, who was the newly appointed head of the Student Health Center. And he was a MD, and I guess also a professor here in medicine, titled Professor of Medicine and head of the Student Health Services, and a gay man. I don't exactly know the details of his biography because he didn't stay around very long after I came back to Madison. He left Madison after having only been here for a few years and got some good job in medicine elsewhere. But he and the members of the committee worked up a report which could be regarded as a kind of a follow-up to the report that the Dean of Students Committee had written and submitted in 1992. And so in 1997, the spring of 97, when I was over in Germany, the Keeling Committee issued a report, and it said it had 18 recommendations, including one to create an undergraduate program in LGBT studies. Now, that was in the spring of 97, and I got back here in the fall of 97, and I've always been very constrained by being in the German department. I have to teach. The German department needs me, needs all the professors, to teach two courses per term, basically, in German, just to cover everything that we have to have for our undergraduate and graduate degree programs. And they can't give me, you know, a course release to teach something in LGBT studies. So I did teach one course on LGBT studies in the German department here, a graduate level course. That had a small enrollment. That was excellent. That was the first and only time that I've taught a gay studies course where all the students who were enrolled in it were gay and were kind of advanced and were knowledgeable and quite interested in the material. And they're now teaching at Miami of Ohio, and one is a dean at Yale, and you know, various people here and there. Very interesting, high-powered group of students, history and German. Well, you know, it was at about that time, it was in the year 2000, that Joe Elder launched his Intro to LGBT Studies course in the Soc department, and it's moved to the Interdisciplinary department, and it's been taught each spring since 2000 by Joe Elder. So it's interesting that the gay studies course here, the Intro to LGBT Studies, is taught by a straight man. It's probably unique in the United States or worldwide. And of course he will tell you that he is highly motivated to do that, as was his wife, Joanne Elder, who was an advisor in Soc until she retired, because they have a gay son. And he came out to them and told them that they, you know, should come to terms with that, and they've been real big-time activists, also coming from their Quaker activism, in the organization Parents and Friends of Lesbians and Gay People, PFLAG, that PFLAG organization, very strong here in Madison. Well,
we're
out of time.
Which means at some point maybe this summer before you go, or maybe when you come back.
Yeah.
Do a follow-up to get the rest of that and some of the other things you want to say.
Right, right.
So,
I hear you,
Jim, I want to thank you very much. It was a great experience, so thank you.